imagine. Kevin, thanks so much for coming on, taking a chance, doing this.
Well, thanks for inviting me. I never expected to be interviewed on your show.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you're such an influence in my life and one of my teachers. And
well, thank you.
You know, because this is a sibling episode, our family values, I've really come down to two things, are the arts and travel.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah. Thank you for joining this kind of special episode, everybody, and be kind to each other and yourselves.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Independent media is now more important than ever, and we want to know how KBOO Community Radio can best serve you. KBOO's Board of Directors invites you to a community meeting on Saturday, February 21st at 11:30 a.m. at the Clinton Street Theater and online via public video conference. This is your opportunity to share feedback, offer ideas, and help guide the station's direction. The meeting will be followed by a social hour. That's KBOO Community Radio's community meeting on Saturday, February 21st at 11:30 a.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. For more information, visit kboo.fm/community26.
Tune in to KBOO on Saturday, February 21st at 4 p.m. for a special Black History Month roundtable discussion on The Motif, Reimagined, a Jazz Sensibility. We welcome four amazing contributors to Portland and Multnomah County civic life in a discussion on public health, politics, and protest, featuring Dr. Gina Gulliam, Dr. James Mason, the Honorable Saran Kopp, and the Honorable Ron Herndon. That's a special Black History Month roundtable discussion during The Motif on Saturday, February 21st at 4 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
It's in our eye like a pizza pie as NASA's Artemis II takes humans back to the moon.
Over 10 days, Artemis II will launch from Florida and head 250,000 miles to the moon. It's a practice run for an actual moon landing, NASA hopes, by 2028.
The first humans to visit the moon in 50 years is big news, but other lunar events are also prompting our skyward gaze. Scientists are tracking an asteroid that's on a possible collision course with our lovely natural satellite. Meanwhile, new studies are brightening our understanding about solar storms and how we might protect Earth from their high-energy particles.
It affects things like electrical grids. Anything with a long wire becomes a voltage source, and that can damage equipment.
Welcome to Big Picture Science. I'm Molly Bentley. In this episode, we present an assortment of new solar and lunar science that we'll tease by sharing a small galaxy of intriguing names associated with them. The Far Side Seismic Suite, Schrodinger's Crater, Punch, something called 2024 YR4, as well as Artemis II. A lot is happening in this episode. It's a celestial shakeup. If Artemis II heads to the moon in early 2026 as planned, some people may experience nostalgia.
10, 9, ignition sequence start.
The 1969 Apollo moon landing wasn't the last manned mission. Apollo 17 delivered two astronauts to its rocky surface in 1972. Astronaut Eugene Cernan was the last man to lift his boots off the regolith as he climbed back into the lunar space module with a desire to return.
We leave as we came, and God willing, as we shall return.
But no human has walked the dusty surface since. A year before Captain Cernan died, Seth Shostak spoke with him about his then new documentary, The Last Man on the Moon, and his frustration that we hadn't yet returned.
Gene, you were the last guy on the moon when you stepped back into the module. Did you know that you would be the last guy on the moon?
Well, we knew Apollo 17 was the last flight of Apollo. And I sort of figured I'd be the last man on the moon in the 20th century. But here I am 43 years later, still the last man on the moon. Give me a break. That tells us what we have not done in the last four decades.
If they put you in charge of the program, what would you do differently?
We'd be back on the moon by now. We'd be developing the moon, the resources, and if I had been elected president 40 years ago, we'd be on our way to Mars long ago. Now, it sounds easy, and maybe it sounds easier to say than do, but it could be done, and we could have done it. We were ready to do it. It's the most disappointing thing in the world for me today to have this yoke over my shoulders, being called the last man on the moon. Oh, you know, fine, that's great. It's a handle people put on me. But the reason behind this documentary of mine is to stimulate and inspire those young kids, because one of them's out there today and they're going to take us not only to the moon. I don't know whether you will. I won't. But one of us will be around to see him go to Mars.
Thanks, Gene. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Well, astronaut Gene Cernan is getting his fervent wish, sort of. More than a half century after Apollo 17 departed, humans are returning to the moon, though not yet to its surface. Four astronauts will orbit the moon in a 10-day mission planned for March 2026, and a landing should follow with Artemis III a year later. But as we said, that's not the only lunar event creating a stir. Here to put all the events in context is science writer and BBC contributor Roland Pease. Okay, Roland, is a return to the moon merited?
Hi, Molly. Great to be back. You know that clip of Gene Cernan going up the steps? It just always gives me the chills. You know, there's a sort of loneliness almost about it.
When he actually enters the module.
Yeah, and you know it's the end of an era. And that's, you know, that's what this is about. In fact, I spoke to Jack Schmidt, his colleague, who's the other astronaut on the moon back then on Apollo 17. He was actually the only scientist who took part in the Apollo missions. He was a geologist. He trained all the other astronauts who went to the moon, and then he got to go there.
This is Harrison Schmidt. I am the 12th man to have set foot on the moon. We were in a deep valley, deeper than the Grand Canyon of the Colorado, looking at a brilliantly illuminated desert-like landscape, with a sun as bright as any sun one can imagine, but set in a black velvet sky, with the only color visible being that of this blue and white marbled earth. that was hanging over one of the southwestern walls of this canyon.
And he was so keen when I spoke to him also to have a return, and not to do it like a camping trip, which is what the Apollo missions were like, but to put a base there, to put a base on the moon, which is what the goal of the Artemis missions is to be.
I think we passed the stage of true exploration. There is still a great deal to be done. There are many parts of the moon we've never been. But I believe that the next expedition to the moon will be one more akin to the construction of the railroads in the American West. So I expect that the next wave of human activity on the moon will indeed be one of settlement, not only on the moon, but ultimately on Mars, and then beyond that into the universe itself.
So the point was is that he felt, as a geologist, that there was a lot of science to be learned on the moon.
Well, there was science, actually. He was very, shall we say, pragmatic. He's still alive, by the way. But he was really interested in all the resources there.
But Roland, we now understand what some of the aspirations have been for going back to the moon from previous astronauts. Why are we going back?
It's a good question. Because there's so much to learn. I mean, there have been a huge number of uncrewed missions that have been going around. The Chinese have landed a number of landers on the moon as well, which have been doing more science. But, you know, it's our twin. It was born out of the collision. But, yeah, there's the political thing. There's the fear that maybe China might even get people on the moon before America does. Their missions have been amazing. And, yeah, there are these politically motivated ideas of getting to Mars.
Well, concurrently with those missions is another mission that is causing, we can say, a little bit of a shakeup. Introduce us to the Farside Seismic Suite.
This is the idea of sending a science package to the far side of the moon. So, in other words, the bit that never looks towards us. And on board that will be a seismometer, a set of seismometers.
But not the first time that seismometers have been on the moon.
No, they took some up with the Apollo missions. But, you know, those are very old, and there's so much more yet to, again, so much more to be learned, especially if you can put it on the far side. They're going to land, they hope, in this wonderful crater, huge crater, 320 kilometers across, called Schrödinger's crater. It's not like Schrödinger's cat, it really is there.
All right. Well, at a recent science conference, Carrie Nunn, a lunar seismologist and planetary scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, introduced us to the concept of seismic activity on the moon in the form of moonquakes.
So there really are moonquakes. And moonquakes, there are different types of moonquakes, and there's some really fun differences between what you might expect from an earthquake versus a moonquake. Like, for example, moonquakes are much longer. A decent-sized moonquake could last 3 hours.
Now, I come from California, and we get nervous when an earthquake lasts for 5 seconds or more. 3 hours, goodness sakes. You said that there are different kinds of quakes. How so?
So there are, for example, some moonquakes which are caused, they're very deep in the moon, and they are caused by the tides. So this would be the Earth acting on the moon as it orbits around us. It's changing the interior, and that makes it move, and then you can get these seasonal moonquakes related to the Earth's tides.
We know that the moon has a pull on the Earth, and that's what causes the tides, but you're saying it goes the other way around, that the Earth's tides pull on the moon and on the interior of the moon. And what exactly is moving then? What is it? Can we just imagine that the crust is moving, or is something in a layer in the interior is moving? And is it also fracturing the way that we have these rifts in the Earth's crust?
Yeah, so we don't know exactly what's moving, but we think it would be the mantle that's moving, and then, you know, above that we have something kind of moving in the crust. If these quakes are as deep as we think they are, then it has to be the mantle which is moving.
Now, you said there was another kind of moonquake, and what is that?
So we also have a different class of moonquake called a shallow moonquake, and we think that these tend to be much bigger, they have much higher frequencies, and they may be related to the edge of some very large craters, and there may be still some, just a little bit of movement kind of closer to the surface, but these are the biggest quakes that we see on the moon.
And those are also tidal quakes?
They don't seem to be related to the tides. It might just be that something cracks, you know, that we don't really know what the mechanism is for those types of quakes.
Well, sometimes we all crack, so maybe we can relate to that, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Now, I understand that, I don't know if this is a third category, but some of the quakes or the movement, the seismic activity is triggered by meteors, by objects hitting the moon.
Yeah, a lot of activity on the moon is caused by meteoroids impacting onto the surface. And because the moon has no atmosphere, so anything that hits the moon is going to be hitting very, very fast. Almost kind of unimaginably fast, and then but there's a huge range of size, so it could be something, you know, if you look at the size of some of the craters on the moon, you know, which are like 300 kilometers width, you know, that those are fortunately in the past. But we also have, you know, you can have beta scale and you can have like something really tiny. So the whole moon is kind of covered by these things, which are, you know, are like all different scales. Like every single surface is pitted with these like meteoroid impacts. But if we have something reasonably large, it creates a quake that propagates quite similar to any other quake. And then what we can also kind of use that to probe the interior, that we use it to look at what's happening underneath, like within the moon.
Let's talk about how you're going to measure that. How do you go about measuring quakes on the moon?
So we have two things. We are taking some new seismometers to the moon, which we will measure these quakes. We've got a couple of different ways of getting there. One will be on a lander. That's the Farsight Seismic Suite, which is going to the far side of the moon. We're going to be putting a seismometer on the deck of our lander.
What do we hope to learn about from studying these moon quakes?
I mean, there are so many unanswered questions about the moon. We don't know, for example, how thick the core is. We don't know a great deal about the crust. We don't know how the maria on, you know, like the what we call the seas, like the dark patches that you can see on the moon. We don't know how they were emplaced. So there's just many, many questions that are still like out there to answer.
To be clear of how a seismometer can help you do that is you're looking at the wave propagation through the moon, so through all these different layers, and is it that how that wave moves tells you something about the makeup of the moon?
Yes, absolutely. So we should be able to tell, for example, the thickness of the crust and how that varies across the moon. That, you know, the far side seismic suite, we've actually never sent seismometers to the far side. So we expect it to be very different from the near side. So we're looking at regional differences in seismicity. So that's the first thing, is looking at the crust. We can also look at the mantle. We can look at how thick the core is. There's a lot of kind of structure which is possible to get out of these data, especially because we're going somewhere new.
So it's making the invisible world visible through pressure waves.
Absolutely, yeah. It's a nice way of putting it.
Well, then finally, can you update us on what we know about the relationship between the moon and the Earth? Is the understanding still that the Earth was hit and the moon is what was ejected and the moon is a part of us? We could put it that way. Is that still the understanding?
Yeah, so I think the theory is that there's a planet-sized object called Theia. It's just got a name. It doesn't exist anymore, which is about the size of Mars. It's that kind of size, a bit smaller than the Earth. So it hit the young Earth. And then it vaporizes. It's absolutely catastrophic. You don't want to be around when it happens. And then some of that, it probably forms some kind of disk, and some of that spun off and becomes the moon, which explains why the moon has so many similarities between, you know, with Earth. It's very different from anywhere else in the solar system, and they're kind of paired.
Well, Carrie Nunn, thank you for sharing a little bit of lunacy here at the AGU. Really appreciate
yeah.
it.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Carrie Nunn is a lunar seismologist and planetary scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory and part of its Farside Seismic Suite mission.
Roland, help us understand the difference between the far side of the moon and the dark side of the moon. Are they the same thing?
The dark side of the moon is the part of the moon that's not facing the sun. Yeah. So when we've got a full moon, it's the other side of the moon. But when we've got the crescent moon, then we're looking at the dark side of the moon. But the far side of the moon, the moon always shows one face to us. That's the point. Sometimes it's dark, sometimes it's bright, but there's this other side of the moon, which is actually quite different, like Harry said, from the near side, about which we really want to learn a lot more. So it's also the hard part to get to.
Well, it's good to know that the moon isn't two-faced. I know that you find these seismometers quite interesting for a number of reasons. Just riff on that a little bit.
Well, I suppose Kerry didn't quite put it this way, but it's like a CT scan or an ultrasound of the moon's body, because it looks inside. That's the amazing, the wonderful thing. You know, the seismometer that they're using, the Farsight mission, is based on the one that was on InSight, which is on Mars, which they've used to measure the core of Mars. So that's the kind of thing you can do with it.
InSight is the lander on Mars, the Mars
lander.
That's
right.
Yeah.
Exactly. And the other thing which I quite liked is that they're going to put a set of telescopes around the Earth so that no matter what time of day, one of them will be pointing at the moon, and they will see if there are any of these meteor impacts on the moon's surface, because there'll be a slight flash from them. And that means that they'll know exactly where the sound waves, where the seismic waves started from, which can then be picked up by the seismometers. And you can then do all that clever analysis, which, you know, you live in California, Molly. There's a lot of that goes on with earthquakes as well.
A lot of clever analysis or shaking of the ground?
Well, a bit of both, of course.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars.
Well, it looks like some of that analysis may be put to use sooner rather than later. Roland stays with us because he turned up another story that might make good use of those lunar seismometers in a dramatic fashion. It is a prospect that the moon could get all shook up.
Something hitting the moon like this is unprecedented as far as we know in terms of being recorded.
Sounds like a blast. We'll also be talking about blasts from the sun, solar storms, and how we track them. This episode of Big Picture Science is tracking celestial shakeups. When a meteor hit Mars in December 2021, NASA was ready. Its InSight lander was already on the red planet with a seismometer on board. Here's the sound of the meteor's impact. The vibrations sped up about 100 times so you can hear it. Science writer and BBC contributor Roland Pease tells us why we might have a similar sequence of events playing out on the moon. How is that, Roland?
It all starts out with an asteroid called 2024 YR4, which, if you dig into your memory banks, you might remember, because about this time last year, there was concerns that it might hit the Earth, and it would be big enough, if it hit in the right place, to wipe out a city. So that was a pretty serious concern. Briefly, eventually they found out that it's not going to hit the Earth, but they found it still had a 4% chance of hitting the moon.
With the very clever name 2024 YR4, you know, we've heard some great names in the episode so far. This may not be one of the most creative names.
No, the catalogs are full of these asteroids with just numbers like this. 2024 is when they discovered it. YR4, well, basically it was right at the end of December 2024 that they discovered it.
This asteroid may be on a collision with the moon. It's never happened with humans as a witness.
And the great thing is that, as Kerry Nunn was telling us, there's going to be seismometers on the moon. So there's going to be something to record all that signal from it. I turned to planetary defense expert Andy Rifkin of Johns Hopkins University's Applied Physics Lab.
There is a 4% chance that 2024 YR4 will hit the moon in December of 2032. It would probably, if it were to hit, we think it would make a crater on the moon's surface about a kilometer across. Then all of that all of the stuff that used to be where the crater is would get thrown up into space. Some of it would land on the moon. Some of it might escape. And in fact, there's a lot of current research being done as to how much would escape, whether any of that would make its way toward the Earth. Anything that did make its way to the Earth would be small, so just dust, not a hazard to us here.
There could be meteor showers, I guess. Then.
But yes, there could be meteor showers.
Shooting stars,
yes.
To be clear, nothing like this has happened before in sort of modern science time.
Oh no, absolutely not. Yeah, there was something about this size that we think hit in Siberia about 120 years ago, but it hit in an uninhabited area. It hit the Earth. Something hitting the moon like this is unprecedented, as far as we know, in history, in terms of being recorded. It's happened probably a million times since the moon was formed, 4.5 billion years ago. But the first time that humans would have been around to see anything like this, or certainly would have known that it's happening ahead of time and be able to record it and see it.
The other thing we're talking about in this program is that there ought to be seismometers, new seismometers on the moon by then, possibly some even on the far side of the moon. So I guess the whole thing will also rattle when it's been hit like this.
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. And that's how when the Apollo astronauts visited the moon in the late 60s and early 70s, they brought seismometers with them, and largely to look for impacts, not necessarily impacts this big, but they were able to use those seismometers to detect little impacts on the moon. So a new generation of seismometers placed by either the next generation of astronauts or a robotic spacecraft would also be instrumental, no pun intended, would be really important in getting that kind of data and getting us the detailed results that we could from this.
And one thing is that they could see underneath. They can sort of see inside with the seismic waves, which I guess is quite useful in terms of knowing what the moon is.
Yeah, the seismic waves that would be generated if this hits would basically be probes of all of the material between the impact site and the seismometer. So that's how we've learned about the interior of the Earth from earthquakes and seismometers. That's how we know there's a solid and a liquid core made out of metal from the Earth. All of these details of the Earth's interior come from measuring these seismic waves. We don't really have that level of data for the moon for all sorts of reasons. So it would be a unprecedented opportunity to kind of get that information for the moon.
Okay, so it all sounds very exciting, but this you say it's a 4% or so chance that this is actually going to happen, 96% that it's not. You've not seen, I think, 2024 YR4 since last May. So I guess you could see it for a few months as it sort of flashed through the sky for us, and then it faded from view. Are you going to get a chance to get another view and then to improve, you know, the odds of whether it's going to hit or miss?
Yes, we are. The JWST is the most powerful telescope we have, but it can only look in certain directions because it always has to keep a shade between it and the sun. So last May, it kind of moved out of the range where JWST can look, and it comes back in soon. It might already be back in the viewing window, but all of our expectations are we'll have a couple shots at it here very soon.
And it takes a James Webb, does it, to, because this must be pretty faint. It's sort of disappearing off towards Mars or something at the moment, isn't it? It's orbit.
Yeah, it's very faint. It's kind of at the far end of the asteroid belt at this point, and will kind of slowly start making its way back in. At this point, the orbit is well enough known that we should be able to point JWST, and it'll be on the frame. The details now of is it going to hit the moon, is it not going to hit the moon, are kind of a matter of is it in this pixel or is it 2 pixels over or is it, you know, kind of 2 pixels up. We're kind of at that level, needing that level of precision. And so because we need that level of precision, because we're looking at something that's so faint, that's why JWST is really the only thing we can use to look at it right now.
So you're just going to point the telescope at this sort of point and part of space long enough that you hope that there will be enough light that will make one pixel or another a bit brighter. Is that roughly it?
Kind of, yes. We're also tracking because we know how fast YR4 should be moving. So we're just going to be taking picture after picture after picture after picture for a few hours and then adding them up. And at the end of that, there should be, we have every confidence, a point of light. And as the stars kind of are moving relative to YR4, the stars will make little streaks. And then we'll measure where everything is, whether YR4 is here or here or here, you know, this pixel or this pixel or this pixel, relative to where the stars are. And that should, we expect, give us an answer. We should be able to say if YR4 will miss the moon. If it turns out that YR4 is on an impact trajectory, then we will need more data to really know that for sure. But if it does turn out to be in that 96% that it's not going to hit, we think we should be able to figure that out.
Just give it a nudge in the right direction to make sure it does. I bet that's what you'd like.
A lot of people in the community definitely are rooting for it to hit the moon because of all of this great science. Personally, I'm kind of in the do not disturb camp. I think that, you know, letting the universe go about its business unless we really need to do something is kind of where my head is at.
Thanks so much for joining us, Andy. Andy Rifkin.
Thank you.
From Johns Hopkins.
That's planetary astronomer Andy Rifkin of the Applied Physics Laboratory at Johns Hopkins University putting a new spin on the idea of being moonstruck. You know, Roland, if we connect the idea of the moon being hit by an asteroid with what we heard earlier in the show about NASA's return missions to the moon, it might be fun for scientists, but it could actually have serious consequences if humans did have a base on the moon.
Absolutely, actually. You know, Andy talked about the spray of ejecta that would come out of it. A lot of that would land back on the moon. And so, yeah, the danger would be of rocks orbiting the moon and then crashing back onto the surface. And whether it's astronauts or whether it's scientific equipment, you can imagine that would be a pretty dangerous place to be.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
Well, moonlight, of course, is reflected sunlight, and now we turn to new tools being used to study the biggest source of light in our solar system. And Roland, that includes protecting ourselves from its energetic particles.
Absolutely. Let's turn to the sun. You know, so apart from the cosmic dust and grit and apparently the occasional bit of moon that burns up in our atmosphere to give us shooting stars, we're in a continual stream of ions, charged atoms, which are blowing out from the sun, which is a solar wind.
So now, Roland, is that happening all the time, that solar wind? Like, can we feel it now?
That's constant. That's absolutely constant. But on top of that, we then get these solar eruptions called coronal mass ejections, which fly out like ropes of plasma. They expand across the solar system. And if they come sweeping past the Earth, they cause the amazing aurorae like you might have seen just last month. Did you see the fantastic colours of reds and greens and curtains and beacons of light up in the northern sky?
I did not see them, but if they were red and green, it would have been appropriate for the holidays, right?
No, I didn't see it either, but that's because it was raining. I did go out to look. But so these geomagnetic storms are absolutely wonderful to look at. They've been actually quite a series of them over the past 2 years because there's been a peak of solar activity. But the downside of them is that they can affect satellites. They can affect the GPS signals that we get from satellites. And, you know, that gets in the way of our navigation. Beyond that, the really spectacular aurorae we saw last month were also accompanied by a second thing, which was called a radiation or a proton storm. It was a particularly intense. It's more intense than they've seen for about 20 years. And those can endanger astronauts. You'll hear a bit more, actually, if you listen to this interview I did with Ryan French of the Laboratory for Atmospheric and Space Physics in Colorado. He gave me some of the detail of what was happening last month and over the past few years.
Yeah, so the sun follows this 11-year solar cycle of increasing and decreasing activity on the sun. The peak of this cycle, which we call solar maximum, happened back in October 2024. So we have passed this peak. So we are entering the declining phase of this cycle, but we are still in a period of very heightened activity when these events are more common.
I mean, that seems to me a bit odd. How could you have so much activity when it's declining? Is it sort of less but sometimes more exciting?
That's a very good question. Yeah. So in general, during this declining phase, we expect fewer events, but those events that can happen can be larger. So historically, previous solar cycles, we typically see the strongest of these events aren't actually around solar maximum. They're in the few years that follow.
So we can hope for some more of them in the next one.
We can certainly hope for some more. More is not guaranteed, but we have decent chances that we will have some more strong geomagnetic storms before the cycle's done.
The aurora, just explain what it is that connects what goes on the sun to the aurora that we see.
So we have these events on the sun called solar flares. These are these bursts of light in the atmosphere of the sun. And in about half the cases, these solar flares will trigger an eruption of plasma from the sun. These travel relatively slow. It takes about a day to 3 days to reach us. Still very, very fast, right? We're talking 1,000 miles per second. But compared to light, this thing is slow. And as this travels from the sun to the Earth, it carries with it a strong magnetic field. And so this magnetic field from this structure from the sun smacks into Earth's magnetic field, which sort of protects us from the worst of these events in space. And that causes Earth's magnetic field to wobble and be compressed. And we call that a geomagnetic storm. And as that happens, these high energy particles from this interaction and from the sun enter our magnetic field. They flow along it down to the North and South Pole. They collide into our atmosphere. And that causes our atmosphere to glow, which is what we see as the Northern and Southern Lights.
Now, what you pointed out to me was that the exciting part of this was this geomagnetic storm. But for you solar astronomers, there was something much more significant going on.
That's right, yes. So there are multiple components of these eruptions from the sun and this sort of space weather system. So this geomagnetic storm, which we've been talking about, is this magnetic structure coming from the sun. But there was another type of space weather which we experienced called a solar radiation storm. And these are high energy protons and electrons, so individual particles. And these got bunched up in front of the shock that came with this eruption from the sun. And these hit Earth at levels not recorded in decades. So this is the first severe solar radiation storm we've had since 2003.
So this is like a shower of particles.
That's right.
A stream of sort of subatomic bullets.
In a way, yes. Subatomic bullets slamming into Earth.
And why are they important?
So they're certainly very important for a multitude of reasons. They can damage spacecraft, computer systems in certain ways, but more importantly than that, they can be harmful to biological health. So human life, for example. Most events, including this one, are not measured from the ground. So if you're down on the ground, we're not experiencing any increase in radiation. But up at commercial flight altitudes, especially near the North and South Pole, there is an enhanced radiation risk. So during times and events like these, flights will typically be diverted away from the North and South Pole. But particularly at risk are those astronauts up in space. So this isn't sci-fi, right? You don't have these events and you're fried. But over time, sort of exposure to particles like this, it is a radiation risk. So your risk comes from your lifetime accumulation to this radiation.
I mean, if we're protected down here by the ionosphere, by the magnetic field, I'm particularly interested in the astronauts who are about to go out on the Artemis missions out to the moon. That's way beyond any magnetic protection, is that right?
That is beyond pretty much all of Earth's magnetic protection, yes. So you would be particularly vulnerable out there to an event like this one. Thankfully, this one that we've just had is, as we said, a very rare event. So hopefully future Artemis missions will go and come back without any large events like this. But in the International Space Station, there is an increased risk from these events.
And for people going to the moon or even being on the moon?
So lunar expeditions, I don't know what the official protocol is there. You know, these ships that are going to the moon and back, they do not provide as much natural protection as the International Space Station. They're just not as big, simply, right? So there's no way really to avoid that exposure other than forecasting. So if there is a very large event like this predicted or on its way, they would delay that launch. But, you know, these missions are 10 days long, so there's no way you could forecast 10 days ahead of time. So there's a little bit of luck involved, unfortunately.
On that forecasting, you know, you see something going on the sun. Mm-hmm. How good are we at knowing what's going on the sun relates to then what's going to happen here on Earth a day or two later. And particularly these proton events, do you know if they're going to happen, or do we just know when they actually arrive?
So there's a mixture of different processes. So when we see a solar flare happen on the sun, we can then typically see if there's an eruption leaving the sun, this coronal mass ejection. We can look at the images from that, look at that data, and we use modeling to try and predict when that eruption is going to arrive at Earth, how hard it's going to hit us, when it's going to hit us too. So that gives us a little bit of observing capability, and that gives us maybe a day, a couple of days if it's a slow event, and we might expect to see this pick up in these protons around this stuff too. So that we have a way of predicting, although it is has its limitations. But the solar flare itself, the thing that kicks off this whole reaction, is very difficult to forecast. We can look at these complex regions on the sun above sunspots, which are where these events form, and we can sort of say, okay, this event is, or this region is kind of complicated. We might expect this to produce a very large flare 1 in 5 days, maybe 20% of the time. But that's kind of the limit of flare forecasting at the moment. It's kind of probabilistic. And so these proton events, these solar radiation storms, these can come with this eruption from the sun, but they can also come from the solar flare too, which is much harder to predict and forecast.
That's solar physicist Ryan French at the Laboratory for Atmospheric and Space Physics in Boulder, Colorado. He's also the author of Space Hazards, Asteroids, Solar Flares, and Cosmic Threats. Next, here comes a space mission that will help us better understand and forecast those energetic solar storms. That new mission is sure to punch up heliophysics. Find out why as we continue a celestial shakeup in this episode of Big Picture Science. There's a new constellation in the sky. Launched in 2025, NASA's so-called Punch mission is a constellation of 4 small satellites in low Earth orbit with the aim of studying the sun's corona and its solar wind. Developed by Southwest Research Institute, they use camera-like systems to track the movement of the sun's energetic environment. Roland, how will the Punch mission address some of the concerns about solar storms disrupting our electronic equipment that Ryan French described to us?
Well, one of the things that Ryan mentioned was that it takes about 2 days for one of these coronal ejections to reach us here on Earth. And in fact, what that means is that for 2 days, they don't really know what's going to happen. So, you know, we've got amazing cameras that can watch in incredible detail what's going on the sun. I really urge people to go and find some of those imagery on the internet. But for the 2 days that it's coming across towards us, we're blind. We're completely blind. And I think one of the promises of the Punch mission is that, because it's a really wide field camera, effectively, it's giving the astronomers a chance to understand what happens in those 2 days and then maybe get a better idea of what it is that's going to hit the upper part of our atmosphere, you know, and cause those aurorae and maybe damage those satellites.
Well, I met up with one of the principal investigators of the Punch mission at a recent science conference.
I am Craig DeForest, and I'm the PI for the Punch mission. That's principal investigator. I'm at Southwest Research Institute.
And what kind of scientist are you?
I am a heliophysicist. Heliophysics is a word now. So I study the sun and its environment as a unified system.
Before we get to the spacecraft that are going to look at this environment, describe how space weather or what's happened on the sun actually affect how we conduct our lives.
So the most obvious way for most people is when there is a large space weather event. This is a disturbance that crosses the inner solar system from the sun and impacts the Earth. When there is such an event, we see aurora. When that happens, Earth's magnetic field actually shifts slightly in response to the solar wind. Compasses can be deflected ever so slightly. But more importantly, it affects things like electrical grids. Anything with a long wire becomes a voltage source, and that can damage equipment equipment that's important to us for lighting our homes. And radio communications are disrupted at high altitudes, like on aircraft. People experience more ionizing radiation from space than they would otherwise. That's important to crews and in some cases even to passengers. We can have radio blackouts where long-distance radio communication fails, and that causes flights to be diverted around polar routes into lower latitudes, which cost fuel. So between all these effects, none of them would affect us if we didn't have technology, but they affect our technology. And so now that we are a society that depends on technology, we have to care about space weather.
Okay, so let's hear more about the spacecraft, or these four spacecraft that make up Punch.
We like to say it's one instrument mounted on four spacecraft. And we are looking at the entire inner solar system all the time to track space weather across it and to observe the sun's corona and the solar wind as a unified system. We have four spacecraft. They're all orbiting Earth over the dawn-dusk line. Remember, sunset isn't a time in orbit. Sunset is a place. And so we have all four spacecraft spread around the planet over the dawn-dusk line so that they can see the sun 24 hours a day. They use the sun, of course, for power, but they're observing the corona and the solar wind coming out from the sun. The reason we have four of them is we're making a lot of data. We're taking a polarized image set. It's three images every 4 minutes around the clock. That's a lot of data to downlink over the radio to the ground. So we had to be close to the ground to do that. That meant there was a planet in the way. So we had to spread out.
We have a lot of affection for that planet, though.
We do. But it gets in the way. So we spread out the instruments so we can look out in all directions at the same time. And we use polarization because that allows us to discern the three-dimensional structure of the objects we see. But the movies that we're producing give us a unique view on our home in space, right? We can see the pageantry of the cosmos playing out. We can see the planets moving around. We can see comets moving by. We can see our star against the backdrop of the zodiacal constellations and the galaxy itself. It's really, for me, a chance to see our neighborhood in space. This is where we live.
You showed that image. Well, it wasn't an image. It was a video of the heliosphere. And up to now, you said, we've really just had images of the corona and the immediate area immediately around the sun. But this was a vast area of activity and of wind. And as I understand, one of the first images or one of the first videos to depict it. Can you describe what it was that you showed us and why it is a first?
So what we're seeing with Punch every day routinely around the clock is a 90-degree field of view centered on the sun. That's from the horizon to the zenith. It is a huge field of view. So we are not another NASA space telescope. We're a wide field imager that's showing what's going on around us as the space weather sweeps over the planet. So it really does give us a sense of place for astrophysics at home.
In this video, it looked like wind. We know that the sun is dynamic itself, but the area around the sun is also extremely dynamic. And that was just lovely to see and an eye-opener. What is that that's happening?
So in that movie, in addition to the planets that form a backdrop, you can see the corona in near the sun, which is ultra-hot material that's much hotter than the sun itself, much larger than the sun, though more tenuous. So hot, that material spreads out through the solar system. And for the first time, we can see every day the clouds and the roiling ejecta that come shooting out of the sun in all directions all the time.
In this image, you also have the image of a comet coming through, and its trajectory is perturbed by what's happening in the sun. And we think of comets as being kind of straight shooters, or at least going on an arc. How is that solar wind affecting comets?
In the sequence that I showed, you can see Comet Lemon in the north, traveling around the sun, And it's actually bathed in the solar wind, just like we are. So comets have a tail of material that streams out of them. It evaporates from the solar heat as they get close. And that tail itself is affected by the solar wind. So you can see immediately that the solar wind actually is affecting the things it sweeps over. In this case, you can see the effect in the comet tail as each coronal mass ejection sweeps over it. Understanding the structure and the changes in the comet tail is an important probe for us of what's actually happening, even though we don't have a spacecraft right there.
Well, so finally, Craig, in the session today, there was also a presentation about IMAP, which is looking also at the heliosphere, and then along with the NASA mission that is already underway, the Parker Solar Probe. Could you imagine at some point that we would have real-time warning systems, or even sharper real-time warning systems for when space weather is going to hit our spacecraft or any of our electronics on Earth?
Absolutely. A direct result of this fundamental science we're doing now is the ability to forecast solar storms better. IMAP in particular will improve in situ sampling, so we'll get better warning systems for immediate warning of a solar storm hitting the Earth. Systems like Punch itself, will track solar storms across the solar system in 3D. Right now, we extrapolate from a couple hours of data near the sun all the way across the solar system to try to forecast when solar storms will happen at the Earth. With systems like Punch and with Punch itself, we can track these storms in three dimensions directly. It's like having a weather satellite tracking a hurricane versus trying to forecast it from just a few samples on the ground.
So we may have not shake alert, but solar shake alert.
Absolutely.
Our phones one day.
Early warning systems. Absolutely. NOAA, of course, does the forecasting, and NASA is doing the fundamental research to enable that forecasting.
Where can the public see that brilliant video that we saw today?
The public can go to our website, punch.space.swri.edu, and the video will be posted there.
Craig DeForest, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
Craig DeForest is a heliophysicist at Southwest Research Institute and a principal investigator on NASA's Punch mission. Well, Roland, now we turn to you for the big picture perspective on the new lunar and solar research we've been hearing about in this episode.
One of the things I really like about this episode is that, for example, with Craig DeForest, you know, he's talking about looking at the connection between the Earth and the sun. And that, in a way, takes us back to the very first discovery of the space age, when NASA launched its Explorer 1 satellite into orbit around the Earth, and they discovered almost instantaneously the Van Allen belts, which are part of the magnetosphere. So this was the first discovery back in 1958 of what's around the Earth.
So the Van Allen belts, these are these rings of energetic particles that circle the Earth?
Yeah, they're part of this whole magnetospheric protection that we have that protects us from the solar wind. At the same time, Eugene Parker was exploring the first ideas of what drives the solar wind and what drives the eruptions. There's a probe, a space probe that NASA has orbiting the sun at the moment called the Parker probe, which is continuing with that. So you've got this fantastic connection there where, you know, since the 1960s, we've been exploring the environment of space beyond our own atmosphere. And then if you think about these missions to land seismometers on the moon and to try and explore the moon better, you know, that's picking up exactly where Jack Schmidt and Gene Cernan left us at the end of the Apollo mission. So there's a kind of connection between the things we've been talking today and the sort of the heroic age of the space age, which I really love. And if you don't mind me going a bit deeper, Molly.
Do it.
Yeah, okay. For me, looking at space actually brings us back to the beginning of physics, because, you know, in a way, the first explorations we had were when Galileo turned his telescope up to the moon and up to Jupiter and up to the sun, you know, seeing sunspots. You know, that's a bit like the solar storms we're talking about. It was trying to understand those, and with Newton, that gave us the laws of physics and the laws of motion and the laws of gravity and so on. So in a way, I think it's by looking up that scientists have really started to understand better what goes on down here on Earth.
So what you're saying is that the scientists who are looking up today at our sun and at our moon echo the efforts of scientists hundreds of years ago, scientists like Galileo and Newton, who looked up and pondered over the forces that control them.
No, absolutely. It's this sort of continuity, and it's going to go on into the future. So, I mean, what could be better?
This show would not be possible without the luminous talents of senior producers Seth Shostak and Gary Niederhoff, assistant producer Shannon Rose Geary and Brian Edwards, and contributor Sikon Akbon. And a special thanks to science writer and BBC contributor Roland Pease for lending his reporting excellence to this episode. I'm the executive producer of Big Picture Science, Molly Bentley. The original music in the show is by Dewey DeLay and June Miyake. And this episode of Big Picture Science that looks at new lunar and solar research is called Celestial Shakeup.
You are tuned into KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Jazz Lives, right after these news headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7